From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 611, Cloud Ops Advocates with guest Rick Klaus, recorded Monday, September 24th, 2018. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio, bringing back one of my favorite people, Rick Klaus, and I have an out-of-date bio for you, I guarantee it, because this says, Worldwide Technical Community, on behalf of Microsoft, a senior technical evangelist. I don't even know if that title exists anymore.
No, those no longer exist at Microsoft
anymore.
I can pull up my bio if you want.
Just tell me it. I'm, you know.
aka.ms/rclaus
nice.
Bio if you want.
Yeah. I'll add it to the show notes so people have it. But
basically, I still am talking to the worldwide IT community. And the difference is now that I've been empowered and have created a team of what's known as Cloud Ops Advocates.
Interesting.
And so the concept of advocacy is offshoot of developer relations management, if you will.
Right. Because there's also the cloud developer advocates.
Cloud developer advocates, definitely. Rockstar group of folks that are absolutely awesome, totally integrated with the communities that they work with, interoperate with. Not necessarily Microsoft ones. You got Node.js, you got Java, you got Microsoft.net ones as well. But the difference is, the way I like to explain it to people is, evangelism was standing on a corner soapbox with a megaphone talking about product and talking about things.
Right.
It was working with the community, but you're primarily just one direction sharing stuff in. Whereas advocacy is actually being an integrated part of that community and taking their feedback and being their advocate. There's my air quotes you can't see because this is audio.
Yeah, nice. I like the gestures on the air.
You got it.
We have this luxury of actually being able to see each other.
Right.
Normally, we do this over Skype. Then I wouldn't see your air quotes either.
There you go. So basically, advocacy, you are the advocate for the community that you're working with.
Right.
And then you bring that back in the engineering teams. And so, again, in the past, in old structures within Microsoft, the evangelism group wasn't necessarily embedded in working closely with the engineering teams.
Sure.
Whereas the advocacy group is, in fact, a person and a group that has a seat at the table with the engineers.
Yeah, I'm used to dealing with Microsoft where it was sort of, when you had a two-way street, was two different people.
Mm-hmm.
There was the evangelist types that were sort of broadcasting ideas.
Right.
And then you knew someone that you could sort of push in and say, how am I having a problem with this? You think you do this better?
You work around the system to be able to find someone to get some kind of feedback back in again, right?
Yeah. And so, I mean, when I hear advocate, I think it's mostly inbound. But obviously, if I'm asking you a question and you can answer it, it's also outbound.
Right.
Like,
so I like to think of it as like a hybrid environment of both.
Right.
Right. Modern advocacy is both an advocate for individuals and groups and communities that are bringing the stuff and feedback online to make the products better. To solve the customer's issues because it's poorly documented or because there's things that are blocking them from using it. And that basically makes the product better, makes it better for everybody all up. And then there is still sharing of information to be able to get people comfortable using technology, information about cool new things you can do. And the neat thing is that the team that I'm responsible for that I've built up is folks that are talking to what I'm calling the core infrastructure, a Microsoft ecosystem, if you will. A group of folks that we really haven't been talking to very much at Microsoft for a while.
So these tend to be the folks that are running the infrastructure that's using a lot of Windows servers.
Windows servers,
right.
On-premises, SCCM, operations manager. Maybe they've dipped their toe in the cloud a little bit, but not all that much.
Probably not with their primary things.
Right.
And some of them have data centers. Some of them rent data centers or, you know, are under license in different ways. So there's got to be still a lot of models there.
Oh, absolutely tons. And still... Like anything, operations is still around. People are still doing stuff in the operations space. And you've got the issue of people that run the operations of the daily file, keeping the servers running, the lights running, the business running. But then you have groups within there that are much more cloud native and that they're doing stuff with DevOps. They're doing stuff with fast and agile development.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working with SREs, site reliability engineers, for being able to work in this cloud native world. But they still have the operations folks that are keeping the rest of the business up and going.
And this also speaks to me as cloud as architecture, less than cloud as product.
Right.
It's like, how are we using virtualization to create reliability and to be able to deal with burst loads? Like those sorts of problems that, you know, I think back to the dot-com booms where we just like throw more hardware at it.
Yeah.
Where we were deploying to peak.
Yeah. So the path that we have for the conversation that we have, the people that we engage with, basically it's like, hey, how can we help you out? Like, how can we help you get more modern? How can we help you out using more modern solutions within Microsoft, all up, the whole portfolio, not just narrowly focused just on Azure or just on server or whatever it happens to be. I've had a philosophical discussion with my colleague who does the same thing for a team of site reliability engineers or SRE folks. And he's like, we're stuck in this world right now where if you don't modernize your on-premises infrastructure, you're really hamstringing yourself from being able to go in and to use more agile or use more advanced technology because you can't use the basic management tools to be able to automate stuff to the same way you can. Right? So if your base server line for on-premises servers, for your file servers, your DNS servers, your infrastructure that happens to still be there is 2008 R2, you know, end of life's coming.
you gotta
migrate off of it, right? It's staring you in the face. And Microsoft's our own worst enemy. We make a solid product and it just stays there. People don't want to upgrade them and migrate up.
There's nothing wrong with it. It still works.
Still works, but you can't do remote management on PowerShell on it.
Right.
Right?
Well, the other thing that I'm finding now is that gear's aging out. And I'm now confronted with a CapEx cost. And my CTO or my CIO has been reading the trade papers. And like, really? Are we really going to go out and buy another, you know, 2-comma number worth of hardware to replace these ones?
If you need to support on-premises servers for the purposes of the good old-fashioned file shares that haven't been looked after in a while, but they're still there as a rank and file, maybe you've moved off to a NetApp storage solution or some kind of a NAS solution to make it slightly less management, but it's still running old protocols and all things.
Well, and again, you're aging out spindles. Right. Like, we're up against that.
They have to be replaced, right? So now I want to get 2019 in there. Just was going into the announcements here at Microsoft just recently, with it going GA in October. And how do I get my stuff off of those older systems to be able to use newer technology, but then look at it from a hybrid perspective?
Right.
Who are the people that are telling that story about hybrid perspective and on-premises servers?
Yeah.
A lot of the cool folks that are working in the cloud environment don't even want to talk about on-premises stuff.
I had Ned Pyle on the show.
Oh, okay.
So I know the one guy. If it's going to be storage, I know the one guy.
You got to be able to get on.
Yeah. Who is like, Ned's going to give, and of course, he's working specifically on the migration problem.
Right. Absolutely. Right?
And this is the sort of reality of you come at it from a migration problem on-prem, but in native to this entire storage solution in 2019 is, you want some of that in Azure? Yeah, we can do that for you.
Azure File Sync, which is amazing. Exactly. Right? You can say, I want to keep 25% local. Mm-hmm. Then the rest of it ages out as it gets to that point and just moves up inside of the Azure storage.
Sure.
And then we'll be brought back if it's required by someone.
Yeah, so. And it's sort of the same way we got used to treating our NVM storage and our SSD storage and our spindle storage differently.
Gold, silver, and bronze class of storage
and
for
now
different
it's
products.
Just like, and of course, the cloud also offers, because you guys have got some real cold storage up there now.
Oh,
it's super cheap for bulk data.
Yeah. It's super cheap. And then we're at Ignite right now, and we just did the announcement of the ultra premium disks that were just announced in Corey's session today, which is a single spindle getting 80,000 IOPS.
Wow.
With sub millisecond latency on those different IOPS, which is insane for a single spindle.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then you even have, okay, well, let's gang them together. And next thing you know, you've got like 160,000 IOPS on two 500 gig small premium SSDs that are ultra SSDs.
Basically running as a RAID 0.
It's insane the performance you can get off of it. So. Yeah.
So, and I love that what's cool about that is when I'm in an operations seat, we're dealing with a performance problem.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, you know, would faster storage solve this problem? You know, the nice thing when you're dealing with the cloud is like, I can have it to you in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Because it's going to take me a while to find some account information. if I was already logged in, it'll take me less.
Yeah.
But like, we can literally experiment with that high velocity storage, see if it makes a dent in this performance problem. Before we bought anything.
Yeah, you buy it on a whim to say, okay, I need to be able to prove this out, and it's going to take me 3 weeks for it to arrive, and then another couple of weeks to be able to write up a test to make sure it works, and then to find out, ooh, I didn't configure that correctly.
Right.
There's bottlenecks now.
I need to troubleshoot them all. I missed this piece. I should have bought that component. Oh, you're going to need one of those. As opposed to, we have a working test suite in the cloud. Now I'm just going to change the configuration options to some of this more premium stuff. Let's see how the performance is. Mm-hmm. And it's cost me $5,
you know. Depends on what you use per minute billing. So that definitely works for sure. So it's a great time.
Yeah. It's
a
great time. Interesting. It's very interesting if you're in it.
Yes.
I just feel like, and I guess you must be feeling the same way. There's a group of people that are sitting behind a fence looking over. They're going, you keep talking about that stuff, but it doesn't mean anything to me.
Right. So that's specifically the types of folks that I'm trying to connect up with once again, that I'm trying to reach out to, and the team is trying to reach out to as well. We're going off to conferences that we haven't been at in a long time. We're going off and talking sessions that we haven't talked about in a long time. And, you know, I get funny looks when I'm, what are you talking about? Oh, I'm talking about Windows Server. It's like,
and why are you here?
Why are you talking about Windows Server? It's like, because it's an awesome solution. People go off and try some things. So, as you mentioned, the idea that we're trying right now is basically just simply show them the option, show them what's there, and then show them the ability to go off and to try some of these hybrid solutions.
Yeah. Build me a path.
Build me a path that'll get there.
It does feel like.
And translate the skills,
right? Yeah, hybrid's never been better.
Yeah.
You know, that's the hardest one in a lot of respects. It's like, it's easy to build a cool cloud thing. You've been building cool on-prem for a long time, but to have those two cooperate with each other, it's not a trivial problem.
Yeah.
How do you address the cloud is going to eliminate my job question?
Well, I have a, session that I talk about this a little
bit.
Yeah. Awesome. I call it, it's about the pivot, right? It's literally about the fact that, you know, I've been in the IT industry longer than I care to admit because I'm getting older every single day.
Yep.
But I've been collecting a paycheck working in IT for over 25 years or something like that. And the old crew basically has a lot of tribal knowledge about how things were built and what things are done and how things work and stuff like that. And it's merely a matter of understanding what the newer technology is and what the pivot is to be able to leverage it or to apply your current knowledge towards it, right?
Yeah.
Like, I lose count with the number of fingers that I have for the number of people that I've had, you know, architecture discussions with how to design a solution for the cloud environment, and they don't understand basic subnetting to be able to go through and to do a multi-layer front back-end solution based on IaaS.
Right.
Because they need to do a in-place migration from your on-premises environment up into the Azure environment, let's say, before they start to spend the time to modernize and to re-envision that project to be able to make it so it's using containers or using service fabric, using something more advanced. They just want to get it out of their data centers and up into Azure.
Right.
And so they don't understand the whole just basic concepting of firewalls and communication traffics between the different boxes and the IP addressing that's involved, people go off and to do that, or the proper storage architecture to get more performance.
Yeah, they're probably doing that with just physical insulation.
Right. So having those conversations is like, you do this now.
Yeah,
like,
whether you knew it or not.
Yeah, whether you knew it or not, you were doing this now on premises, and maybe it was Sally that was in charge of the SAN, you got Bob that was in charge of the network, and you got Joe that was in charge of the individual racking and stacking of servers. Mm-hmm. Now it's a matter of the collective information that they have by an individual themselves to be able to transition to do the same things inside of an Azure environment or an AWS environment, a Google environment, doesn't matter. It's a matter of transitioning those skills up into the cloud environments and then learning the tools to be able to migrate them and use them.
I also think along the way, there's a shopping list here of you going through everything you're currently doing. Or more, let's say more of a manifest.
Mm-hmm.
You also find all the old pain and all the old mistakes.
The technical debt.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Operations technical debt exists.
Totally.
And can be ignored way longer than software technical debt.
Yeah.
Like, literally, the guy who incurred that debt does not work anymore.
Yeah.
Like, he's gone. He retired.
He's retired, or he's moved on to become the CIO. Or
exactly.
They've gone off to a different job, a different company.
And we've just sort of ignored that.
I had a great conversation, actually, with Ned earlier today, another chat just on the side. And he was talking about how he's brought in some junior people, some new people in the VM world. And he's like, Rick, it's just crazy. These new folks coming in, they don't have any of this technical debt.
Right.
They don't have any of these pre-explanations of what subnetting is, how it works. You know, they come from a technology background, but they don't have any hands-on experience working with the stuff that we've had for years. And it's like, they turn up completely different ways of thinking about how to solve problems that we wouldn't even think of.
Wouldn't even think that way.
Because they don't have the technical debt that they would be burdened with.
I called it, you know, people call it wisdom too. I've also called it scar tissue.
Right? I like that one, scar tissue.
And it's sort of this question of, are those scars of those, you know, past wars you fought holding you back from this fairly substantial change that's gone on?
So is it some kind of medicated ointment that we have to have?
Just to rub it on, loosen the vitamin scars? E, get the scars a little looser. But I do think that as experienced folks, you sort of lean on that wisdom a fair bit. And a lot of assumptions that you're making are based on old truths.
Right.
And those truths have moved on.
And so if you pivot, there's my pivot thing, to basically understand that how to work in that new world and try and go down that path to be able to try some of those new technologies, you can take some of that technical debt, that scar tissue that you have,
right,
and then you can apply it to the new modern world of doing things, but then all of a sudden you're now unbound by the issues that you've had of having to procure things, the speed of light for when things arrive.
Sure.
And now you can simply go off and try and play stuff. Like you just mentioned, like you wouldn't be able to do a test of that new super fast ultra premium drive on premises without having to order one.
Right.
And now, as you mentioned, you can put that into a test suite. You can just even spin that up to kick the tires and try it out yourself. And you can have it up and running, as you mentioned, in a matter of minutes.
Well, we used to do a long ROI analysis before we'd commit the funds to something like that.
Right.
We have to be pretty sure it's going to work.
Yep.
But if it's going to cost you half a day and a few dollars worth of Azure time, it's not worth writing it up.
Yep.
Like it's that, that's more expensive than doing the test.
Oh, yeah.
I love everything about that. Got a break for just a moment for this very important message.
You're the SQL Server person in your shop. You never really asked for the job, but you were the one standing next to the SQL Server when it broke. You want to learn to make SQL Server faster and more reliable. Brent Ozar is here to help with online training, and they're on sale this month for 75% off. Go to brentozar.com to learn more.
And we're back. It's Richard Campbell here, Run As Radio. We're at Ignite in Orlando talking to Rick Claus and talking about being an advocate for operations folks that I guess are evaluating the cloud or moving to the cloud or struggling with the cloud. Do you have an order? There's so many products inside that that Azure cluster of stuff, you know.
Let's just say that each time I do a virtual introduction of my team and the concept of what we do to different engineering teams, every one of them kind of sit there just like you're sitting there right now with your hand and you're just looking at me and you get this little smile on the corner of your mouth and it's like, wow.
How am I going to do
this? How can
this?
I work with you guys? Because this is phenomenal. There's actually someone talking and doing this kind of stuff right now. And so far, I have yet to find any single team that doesn't want to work with us. Mm-hmm. And what I've done is, personally, my plan that I have for the team that we've got, you know, we're still staffing up. We don't have a full staff as of yet. I'm focusing on the core pieces of infrastructure that people have and people use, on-premises technology. We've got someone that's more on the cutting-edge cloud-native type of thing as well, which is doing things in the orchestration space with Kubernetes,
right,
but from an IT operations perspective. So he kind of bridges both worlds. From
where do containers come into play from an ops perspective? Because I always thought that was a DevStack thing.
Well, the containers, absolutely.
Right.
DevStack thing. But there's this whole thing of orchestration that goes on in the background.
Yeah,
so you have to worry about it, right?
Yeah.
The security of them,
network,
where you get them from, network configurations, performance, how to get more performance out of them.
Mm-hmm. How do you measure all of that?
All that, so the telemetry, security vulnerabilities, update and management, scaling correctly, that sort of stuff. All that sort of stuff still comes into play in its operation space.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a transition that most folks haven't been able to make, potentially, from working with on-premises virtualization to looking at how containers work and orchestration works and the command tool line works. A lot of the hype and the discussion around containers has all been around the development environment of transportability of the storage of the repositories of and things like that. I can code and work on my laptop. So it's the same containers that I can go and use inside of my account in the cloud and that sort of stuff.
But if you haven't got a mechanism for production deployment, telemetry, you know, recovery, scaling and so forth, like why are the devs even working in that space if you don't have that plan?
Because they need to get the skills to understand how to re-envision their applications, to modernize them and to work in that kind of environment. And hopefully they're going to be working in partnership with their DevOps community within their organization that understands that part. That particular piece of advocacy is one where we have the guy that I've got, his name's Neil Peterson. He's awesome with being able to come from an on-premises background, patch management and control management.
Right.
He got really into understanding how the whole orchestration piece works, the tooling you have to have for it. And basically just applied his on-premises skills to that new world of how things work. And so he's got some phenomenal content that he's made, good speaking that he's done, different sessions.
So hopefully you're finding customers where they've got a test project in dev experimenting with containers. And now the question of what does deployment and operations look like around this? And they hit you guys and are able to get going on that.
Besides just simply doing updates to those containers to be able to make the new piece of code come in and then check it in and do the test, stuff like that. But also, as you mentioned, all the stuff that you would expect to be there from an enterprise environment with backup and restore, disaster recovery, business continuity, security, well monitoring, that sort of stuff. That has to be layered in too.
Yeah.
And so that's where more so the site reliability engineers, the SRE types, are going to be spending their time.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got the new modern leading edge wave kind of covered with a few folks. And I've got the on-premises edge of people that deal with just strictly on-premises migrations, data center closures and movings and lift and shift discussions. That sort of stuff is also covered as well on the team so far.
Doesn't lift and shift make sense just from a point of view of get off the old hardware, get in the new environment?
I don't want to do the CapEx, right?
Yeah, I don't want to renew that data center agreement. I don't want to buy another round of servers. So I'm getting into a place where just get us running the way we were, and then we can start experimenting in the cloud.
It's going to take months. It's going to take years, whatever. And I don't want to have to incur any more of that. I just want to now move it up and make it more flexible.
You know, the Run As Radio website was originally in a virtual machine that ran on-prem. And then we shipped that VM up to the cloud when we could and eventually peeled that IIS instance out as an Azure website.
Right.
Piece by piece.
Each time you're making those progressive steps, you're making it more flexible. You're making it more agile, making it so that you're able to go off and take advantage of more and more of the automation and the technology. Mm-hmm. If you had an ops person looking after the Run-As Radio environment, that individual probably is still doing the same thing as it progresses up the chain.
It's just the tooling's changed.
But the tooling's changed, and they now have more time to be able to work on all the rest of the stuff that they need to do as well.
And that has been my big experience with folks that were concerned is like, what will I do when we move to the cloud? It's like, more.
Yeah, absolutely more.
And more
projects will come up.
I've also, there isn't an IT group in the world that ever got to the bottom of their to-do list, right? Like, that's impossible.
Yeah.
But I also appreciate the idea that you stop spending so much time in the crashing surf of crises and more preventative, planned, thinking about how we do stuff better. What are the opportunities in any of that?
Yeah. We're also exploring off with I'm not going to call them niche, but just simply, again, like cutting edge type things. Mm-hmm. I just saw a session just a little while ago that was talking about, obviously, a whole bunch of stuff going on with IoT.
Right.
And with the Sphere device and other things like that at Microsoft. So I've actually got a guy that's looking at stuff from the perspective of how do you do IoT at scale with security and deployment and management of the IoT for operations folks.
Well, Sphere seems to be there. I'm after Galen Hunt.
Oh, yes.
He's a tough guy. That's a busy man. But I'm after Galen Hunt to do a show on Sphere just because for the first time, I'm sort of looking at a secure from the outset sort of, we've built enough stuff now here that we can give you the ecosystem to be safe.
Right.
Yeah, and when you put the tinfoil hat of security on, this is what scares me if we're introducing this stuff into the organization. It's like all these exploits for all these little IP-owning devices. Mm-hmm. That freaks me out.
The intelligent edge is more than just a marketing term
for
what it comes out to. And that's an area where IT operations folks haven't really had a chance to spend much time in. Mm-hmm. It's, again, been in the realm of the developer world so far to get the stuff built.
Right.
And now it's like, okay, now it's built, or now we've got these projects
and vision prototypes, with them. Yeah.
Now we need to actually put it into production.
Yeah, what does production look like?
And look at it. So
when I think about the intelligent edge from an ops point of view, I see it as admitting that the constraint is bandwidth, that we have enough compute out there on the edge that we can reduce the transmit load. We can pre-work a bunch of data and only send down the results essentially over the wire to the cloud or to our data stores.
Yep.
And that seems to resonate well with operations folks. So why do I care? Just haul the data back. It's like, it's a lot of data.
You don't want to be bringing those egress charges in and out all the time.
Well, and so much of it is repetitive too, especially when you're talking about instrumentation. Mm-hmm. So, putting some technology out on the edge there, they can actually send us the important bits, the consolidated bits of the data. That's interesting.
I've had conversations with folks that are like, okay, well, we'll put the application layers up inside of the Azure environment or inside of the cloud environment, but then we'll keep the data down here because, we're not quite ready to have that workload move at that certain point in time. And it's like, then they're dealing with the latency between the two.
Yeah.
And then different types of connections to be able to enable that. And it's still only the speed of light for how fast you can do that kind of transfer stuff. And you're introducing a whole whack of latency that didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be able to move those data workloads up into the Azure environment too, like you said, and then have simply edge nodes that are closer to you if you needed to be able to go off and consume it.
Yeah. The data sovereignty is still a conversation I'm having regularly.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But, there's more than one way to skin that cat too. Like, I've been dealing with regulations work well. This data must reside in this country. It's like, can it be one of the copies? We're transactionally working at one place, but we're maintaining a copy for regulatory purposes over there. Is that close enough?
Yeah.
So that I'm not actually taking the performance hit.
Yeah. So it's interesting to watch. I mean, the time of recording this, I think we've announced up to 54 different regions right now.
Right.
I think was the number that I heard from Corey's keynote earlier today. And they just keep on popping up.
Mm-hmm.
It's
crazy. And I see you're making... They're not always Microsoft-owned either. I mean, the Germans wanted very specific rules, and you were accommodating. You found a way to...
Same thing with China, with the China...
China's got those rules.
Yeah, it's the capacity that could be inside of every single one of those different countries.
Sure.
And then still have the same experience for how to manage it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Same tooling, same capabilities, same services that are available. And then I had a discussion with one of my folks who's from Australia, and the nuances of being able to provision boxes inside the Australian data centers that are down there.
Right.
Versus deploying them inside the States versus deploying them inside of Canada.
Right.
It's evolving fast.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you're in Southern Hemisphere, so the servers must spin the other way, right?
The
Coriolis effect is applied to the cloud. Is that what that is?
I never thought about that.
It is a cloud, after all. The clouds do spin differently in the Southern Hemisphere. So
I like that. That's a good one.
Yeah. You can have some fun with that. Just leave the whole toilet conversation out. You don't want to go there. It's not a real thing.
Oh, man.
It is interesting to be dealing with that worldwide scope of things. So are we going to see these cloud operation advocates like all over the world, the way the CDAs have sort of spread out?
Yeah, so the COAs, the Cloud Ops Advocates, basically, we're just another group with inside the whole cloud advocacy motion within Microsoft. And the CDAs were the first ones that were there. The COAs are the ones that are the new ones, new kids to the family. And we simply target a different audience. The same mechanism for what we do and how we engage people, go off and speak at conferences, create content online. Engage different types of communities, that sort of stuff. The same principles all still apply. My team currently is based out of North America, as well as Australia. I'm just about to hire someone in Europe. I'm looking for someone in APAC or Asia-Pacific region. It's kind of crazy trying to hire these people around the world.
It's a lot of folks. And I don't want to poo-poo the docs, because as a guy who gathers a lot of links for each show, more and more I'm finding, even on the Run As Radio side, you know, the docs.microsoft stuff, it's the best stuff.
Oh, well, we partner with them because we're part of the same team.
Sure.
The developer relations group at Microsoft sits within inside of the overall sphere of Jeff Sandquist is the one that heads it up. And he includes access and works with the docs folks too. So we actually work with the docs folks to be able to help out and create better contents, maintain that content once it's been made. And then as we are out and talking with people and presenting the content, presenting it at different sessions, if we kind of identify after talking with folks that there's a gap in the docs or there's a gap in how to do something that warrants to have its own doc, but it's not in the main channel of what the PM should write or the doc writer should write, we can go off and write it.
Yeah.
And likewise as well, because docs.microsoft.com is open sourced.
Yeah, it's all on GitHub.
Anyone can go and click on the edit button in the top right-hand corner and be able to contribute to that document to make it even better.
I have submitted spelling mistake corrections.
Oh, I've had a lot of those to fix them. And I've also taken good content. Like, like some person corrected the number of regions that we had and also went through and actually said, you know, this command line you're running, you started off as if you're inside of an Ubuntu box, but then you switched over to Red Hat box.
Right.
With the commit tools using. You know, what's going on?
Didn't actually work that way.
Completely missed the fact that we had combined two articles together.
Right.
And we did it quickly and we missed it. So he fixed it and he gave us the right commands. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll fix that.
That's better.
Done. We can fix it.
You split them apart and make two versions, right? Here's the Ubuntu implementation. Yeah. Here's the Red Hat implementation.
Yeah, definitely.
I like that a lot. Rick, always fun to talk to you. Congratulations on the new role. This sounds like a ton of fun, if a little frightening.
It's a little frightening, but, you know, a little step at a time. It's fun. I get to talk with a whole bunch of people and learned early on in my Microsoft career and in my employment career is that you always work with and or hire people that are smarter than you.
Right, right.
You never hire the ones that are at par or below. It's always higher and smarter, and then your team is going to be successful.
Yeah, no, this is always the shtick of A's hire A's, B's hire C's. Right? So you're an A hiring more A's. I like that.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Rick Kloss, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. We got to do this again more often.
I think so. And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.